You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 22nd, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rosie Collington, PhD candidate at the University College London, co-author, The Big Con, How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Government, and Warps Our Economies. Co-authored with Mariana Mazzucato. Also on the program today, debt ceiling cave negotiations continue as Joe Biden flirts with his constitutional duty to pay the national debt. Meanwhile, Biden's polls in the toilet, but focus groups show Republican candidates are considered worse. Minnesota passes a bill ensuring minimum wage for gig workers. Now raise the minimum wage would be a good idea. Trump's lawyers apparently had warned him over taking classified documents and keeping them. Manchin announces he wants to sink Biden's labor nominee, Julie Sue. NAACP issues a travel advisory for Florida because of Ron DeSantis's policies. 8-year-old girl who died in Border Patrol custody apparently was denied pleas for care for over 24 hours. Bakhmut falls, or all but falls, and U.S. still believes Ukrainian counteroffensive is ready. Meta, nay Facebook, fined $1.3 billion by the EU for privacy violations. The FBI reportedly misused Section 702 to get info on Black Lives Matter protests and January 6th attackers. Lastly, Florida rejects social study books over Holocaust material. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Start of another big week. It is Monday. Of course, Emma Vigeland.
Hello.
Here with us for the beginning of the week.
Yes.
And for the rest of the week.
Yes. That too.
There you go.
Yeah.
We don't need to get into the Celtics. Talk about that later. You'll be able to talk about that on ESPN.
I will.
It's not
I will
really
be. I'm sorry.
Worth putting salt in the wounds. But speaking of salt in the wounds, we're on the verge of a cave, and it's not. I mean, there's a lot of elements about this whole debt ceiling thing, and let's be clear, this is obviously the a function of the Republican Party being completely off the rails and nuts. None of what the Republican Party is doing is in any way unpredictable, a surprise. They did it 10 years ago. They've done it since. But this is really, I mean, this is a replay of what happened 10 years ago. And
this is what we could imagine was going to happen last winter.
This has been an incredibly slow moving train.
Yeah.
And so since everybody in this room knew the Republicans were going to do this, the job of the Democratic Party then becomes, how do we prevent them from doing this? How do we make them pay a political price for doing this? And none of that work has been done. Joe Biden came out, declared, we will not negotiate on the debt ceiling, period. and they have done nothing but negotiate on the debt ceiling period.
Can I give you a quote from Tim Kaine to Politico that'll infuriate you?
Sure.
Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia told Politico that if he could do one thing different, it would have been raising the debt limit late last year. The Democratic Senate aide vented to Semaphore that, quote, the debt ceiling could have been raised in the American Rescue Plan or in reconciliation during last year's lame duck session. On this program, we were advocating for that.
Oh, well, I mean,
hindsight's 2020.
Everybody was. And maybe you could argue that Joe Manchin wouldn't have gone along with it. I don't believe that. But let's just assume that you do. Then at least you know, wait, we still have this debt ceiling thing happening. We know the Republicans are going to hold us hostage. They the administration thought that maybe that Kevin McCarthy couldn't get a bill passed. But here's a piece from Brian Beutler. And he talks about the Democrats like to mock Kevin McCarthy as the dumbest GOP leader any of them has ever had to work with. Nancy Pelosi, who had to work closely with George W. Bush over the years, famously called McCarthy a moron. Does Kevin McCarthy know where he is right now? Her office mocked. Well, joke's on us, because now Democrats will have to explain how that moron maneuvered to get them into a trap we've known about for more than 10 years. He writes, it is possible that the ransoms Dems pay won't be huge. It's even possible to imagine they won't have any immediate force. This goes into it being a, you know, upfront payment on a budget resolution. It's conceivable, in other words, that the material implications of this could be minimal. They probably won't be. They probably won't be. He writes, the impact on the federal budget will be approximately zero if it just so happens to be finagled in that way. However, he says, lower spending levels will stick, at least for the remainder of this Congress. Work requirements will take years to repeal. But just as importantly, any cuts enacted under these circumstances would betray the never again promise Democrats made after the Republicans did this to Obama in 2011. This point is particularly important if the ransoms are small, if the material damage has been kept to a minimum, because it forces us to focus on the violation of principle. The temptation will be to excuse that or to retcon it as some kind of clever Democratic victory over Republicans who are too dumb to understand budgeting. Why sow dissension in the Democratic ranks now if the option to sweep it all under the rug is available? And he writes, because people are smart enough to understand that holding Democratic leaders to account for their failures doesn't make those leaders worse than Republicans. Because we deserve savvier leaders who won't repeat obvious mistakes, particularly recent painful ones, who won't lay responsibility for their mistakes at the feet of voters or activists, because they recognize that electing Democrats can't on its own solve problems that call for the application of raw power. Who can imagine standing up for themselves confidently against bullies as both dignified course of action and a source of political strength? Democrats can elevate leaders like that and beat back the larger threat of Republican takeover simultaneously. In other words, there should be a lot of criticism for everybody who participated in this program. The leadership of the Democratic Party, Joe Biden, his administration, period, end of story. Those senators who did not vote to raise the debt ceiling limit during reconciliation, or thought it was a bad idea, or talked it away, or whatever it was. And that doesn't mean that Republicans are better. No. And it doesn't mean that you're letting things out of the bag. It is like demanding leadership that knows what they're doing. And again, the argument as to whether they purposefully do this because they want to cut the budget or not, we can have that argument. But this is specifically in the context of, like, even if the material implications are not there, this is just a massive political failure.
Yeah.
Because it's also going to happen again.
Yeah, I saw, I mean, David Dayen said it best in his piece in The Prospect today. saying, in this instance, the Republicans are appealing to their MAGA base. They want to have a get a scalp. They want to get some concessions here. And Democrats are appealing to their base, centrist op-ed writers who want the party to appear fiscally responsible as if it matters to anybody.
Civil rights lawyer Joshua Ehrlich said, I'm so tired of this loser. You're the president. Stop asking Sam Alito for permission to do your job.
Well, and here's the thing, the 14th Amendment.
Yes. Yeah. And, there, and here's Joe Biden speaking about the 14th Amendment, which calls for the United States to pay its debts. It is a constitutional responsibility for the United States to pay its debts. Therefore, there are no negotiations about this. You don't need Congress's approval. The executive branch is responsible for this. They need to pay the debt. In fact, it's not even an option. They need to pay the debt.
It's constitutional.
And how they get there, how they decide to do that, is their decision. We could throw it to Congress, but the Constitution says you need to do it no matter what.
Thank you, everybody.
This is at the end of his talk as he's leaving. Go ahead. Keep running.
Thank you, everybody.
We have not come up with a unilateral action that could succeed in a matter of 2 weeks or 3 weeks. That's the issue. So it's up to lawmakers. But my hope and intention is when we resolve this problem, I find a rationale to take it to the courts to see whether or not the 14th Amendment is, in fact, something that would be able to stop it. Thank you.
Okay, so basically what he's saying is that, well, we've run out of time. We had no idea this was going to happen, and we can't invoke. But after this, I'm so steamed about it. We've got to come up with a way of getting to the court on the 14th Amendment, even though there is no case that would be pending necessarily, because, of course, we're going to just agree to these cuts or whatever it is. I mean, this is so pathetic. Mm-hmm. If you could come up with a rationale after the debt ceiling fight, you could come up with a rationale before. But they don't want to go to the... This is so rudimentary, it's almost embarrassing to have to say. You don't ask for permission from a 6-3 Supreme Court. You basically apologize.
Mm-hmm.
And I can assure you, Harlan Crow and his Supreme Court justices do not want a debt ceiling
to go over the president's head right now?
And,
exactly.
And so had the administration, and you know, it's not a question of invoking the 14th Amendment. It's just you're following the law.
And they're protecting the court by not doing it.
Exactly. And
yeah, that's a good point, because if they just tried, then we can have a larger conversation about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, which we should be having, but they don't want that.
They're afraid.
Dick Durbin doing like one little hearing on Clarence Thomas. And is that all we're going to get on Clarence Thomas, by the way?
I'm sure. But the bottom line is they need to just pay the debt.
Yeah.
Stop talking about it. It just announced tomorrow, you know what? I spoke to Office of Legal Counsel, and in fact, we do have the authority under the 14th Amendment. It's pretty straightforward, and we just paid the debt.
Yeah.
And so, end of story.
End of story, and we just, last week, showed a poll, one of the premier polls from University of Chicago on confidence in the Supreme Court. They do it annually. Lowest has been in 50 years. So if the Supreme Court decides, like, hey, we're going to let the U.S. economy fall apart because of concessions that the Republicans are trying to get over just paying the United States' bills, then that's a further ability to undercut the Supreme Court's legitimacy, which is in the interest of the Democrats electorally in the midst of abortion and blah, blah, blah.
What's amazing about this is that there was a Washington Post focus group that looked at 16 voters who had gone from Trump to Biden in 2020 and followed them before then. And they all feel like Biden is too old and they don't want him and they're mad. And then when it gets to Trump, they're like, but he is a nightmare. And yeah, we don't want him as bad as Joe Biden is. And so the point is that the narratives of him being afraid, you know, to be considered an authoritarian or to have gone to the Supreme Court or whatnot, people just want this done. This is a made up thing and they are playing along and it is a real failure. And there's going to be, I mean, you know, again, would I vote for Donald Trump over Joe Biden because of this? No, because the cuts would happen. I mean, it's obvious. But the point is that there's going to be blowback, and it may not be from me, but there's going to be it's going to seriously impact the way this goes. And Boitler's right. You can call for leaders that are savvy and do their jobs well. Mm-hmm. End of story. I hope maybe there's no way he does it, but yeah, there's no doubt. Also, there's some apparently advisors who are pushing it in the administration, but there are others who are pushing harder. Quick word from our sponsor today. Doesn't matter what kind of business you have. I mean, I know this firsthand. I've used ZipRecruiter. In fact, we have an announcement, Brendan is going to be leaving. We're going to announce tomorrow who's going to be filling in for him. This is a remote position that we had in terms of booking. It's tough to say goodbye to Brendan, who's now been with the show for a long time. But I found Brendan on ZipRecruiter. It doesn't matter whether you're starting a new business, whether you're growing the one that you have, you need the most talented people you can get on your team. This is where ZipRecruiter comes in. Right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And in this search, I had set it up on ZipRecruiter as well. And still going through, we got so many candidates. And this is somebody I had interviewed a while back in the last round. But I still contend the best time to put out like a job notice is like when you don't absolutely need it. So you get a notion of like you learned essentially how to hire and how to assess, you know, who's going to be a good fit on your team. And why should you let ZipRecruiter be that mechanism? ZipRecruiter has powerful matching technology. They find highly qualified candidates for a wide range of roles. ZipRecruiter, if you see, you know, resumes on there that you like, you can invite people directly to apply. So they're more likely to apply. ZipRecruiter also offers attention grabbing labels that speak to job flexibility, like remote, training provided, urgent, etc., to help your job stand out. Their user interface, I gotta say, is, for someone like me who is disorganized and not great with things like workflows and some spreadsheet technologies and stuff like that. Super easy. Allows me to track the whole process, how far I've gotten in reviewing candidates, whether I've interviewed them, et cetera, et cetera. Really helpful. Let ZipRecruiter fill all your roles with the right candidates. 4 out of 5 employers, including myself, who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MAJORITY. ZipRecruiter.com, the smartest way to hire. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Rosie Collington, PhD candidate, University College London, co-author of The Big Con, How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Governments, and Warps Our Economies. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Rosie Collington. She is a PhD candidate at the University College London, author of The Big Con, How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Governments, and Warps Our Economies, co-authored, with Mariana Mazzucato. Rosie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on. I was just saying I'm a big fan of the show, so I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm a big fan of this work. I've been a fan of Mariana's for quite some time as well. Then I got to say that's also a very long subtitle that you have. But I want to cover. I mean, I think it really does lay out the problem. Let's before we get to how consultancy does that. Give us a little bit of a history of the development of it. We just had, I think, someone from ProPublica on a couple of weeks ago talking about McKinsey. Mm. And this is McKinsey, but there's a couple others. There's three major consultancy groups, the Boston Consultancy Group, the Bain and McKinsey. But what was the and then, of course, the accounting firms that also do a lot of consultancy work, PwC, which I've learned from your book. Mm-hmm. What was the birth of this? Because there's sort of a chicken egg type of dynamic going on a little bit, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, the kind of core argument of the book, right? We call it The Big Con, but when you get to the end of the book, you learn that The Big Con is actually about the relationship between governments and these companies, and not just something that the companies themselves are doing, right? So they do employ these mechanisms. They do invest a lot in creating the impression that they are creating value for our economies. But obviously, this is also an issue with how governments contract them that we talk a lot about in the book as well.
Yeah, let's start with like the development of that, because even if these consultants were, and we'll go through this, didn't have the conflict of interest that you talk about in the book, even if they didn't sort of weren't expertise and sort of being able to pretend they know what they're talking about, it still is a problematic in terms of the institutions that hire them. But how did this develop? Like when did this become a more significant phenomenon, and what was driving it?
Well, we have a couple history chapters in the book, which everyone is welcome to read. The first chapter really looks at the development and the growth of this industry with kind of wider developments in capitalism, right? So from the end of the 19th century all the way throughout the 20th century. I guess the part where it gets the most interesting for our contemporary situation and the challenges that governments are facing and, you know, really being able to govern is when we get to the 1980s, which might not be a surprise to many of your listeners if they're familiar with the politics and economics of Thatcher in the UK and Reagan in the US. So what we saw during this period from this decade of the 1980s really onwards was that governments introduced reforms that simultaneously reduced spending or reduced resources directly invested in welfare services and increased the use of the private sector in delivering them. And this was really done under this kind of ideology that the role of government should just get out of the way because it doesn't know how to create value for society. What came after that in the 1990s with Clinton and Blair was not so much a continuation of this, right? Because these subsequent governments that came after Reagan and Thatcher, they did see a role for government in kind of setting the agenda and determining what was valuable for the economy and for society. But they didn't see, they agreed with their kind of predecessors, their neoliberal predecessors, that actually government was less efficient than market. And therefore, as much as possible, they should hand over to the private sector. And it was really, during these decades from the 1980s that we've seen the kind of huge rise of consultancies, of management consultancies in government services, delivery, in policy development, in kind of providing advice to government departments. But, you know, we're really interested in the book in the kind of implementation side of things. So what happens when a government department outsources at scale and scope? What happens to the capacity and the knowledge that exists within that organization and the ability to develop it?
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, before we do that, I just want to make that distinction between implementation and policy development, because that's also, problematic. It's one thing, I guess, if you're a small town to say we can't maintain our own fleet of plows to plow when it snows. It's just not you know, efficient at that way. We're going to hire local guys with pickup trucks and with the other trucks to plow. It's another if I say, and we're going to let them decide when we deploy the plows, because then all of a sudden, like, you know, half an inch of snow and they're going out there because they have an incentive. Just talk about that dynamic before we get into some of the actual case studies.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was going to come back at you with a case study. So one of the cases that we look at in the book is the development and implementation of healthcare.gov, right? So this was the platform for market exchange that was part of the Affordable Care Act. And it was really, you know, the landmark reform of Obama's period in office, right? And what we discuss in the book, what we look at in the book, is the scale and scope of outsourcing, of contracting out, that occurred in the development and implementation of this online platform, right? This wasn't a case of just bringing in a few experts to advise, which, you know, with new technologies, it's almost invariable that governments and any organization are going to need some specialist knowledge and specialist experts to come and advise from the sidelines and help them implement that. And also recruit new people in. But this wasn't a case of that. This was a case of outsourcing the development and implementation of healthcare.gov to some contractors, including CGI Group, which is an IT consultancy. It does a lot of management consulting work. And, you know, as many of your listeners will be familiar with, it was a colossal failure on the day that it was supposed to launch. Massive. In October 2013. Only six people were able to get their health insurance. You know, it was an obscene failure.
It was an obscene failure, and both in terms of the material implications, but that the failure of that website was talked about for years as an example of government yeah. incompetence. And in fact, it was the private industry failure that it was all about.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. And this is where it comes back to the big con and the problems that we have in our economy with the way that governments and businesses also use consultancies. This being an issue of not just the companies themselves, right? Not just the supply, but also the demand, the way that governments see that they should be outsourcing in these ways. So there were problems with the way that government chose to contract these contractors to develop healthcare.gov. But absolutely, I mean, the failures, the types of failures that have been talked about in the public sphere have been failures of these big companies basically failing to deliver what they promised to deliver. But of course, it was also a failure of government, you know, contracting them in the first place. But you know, largely, as we kind of find in the book, the conclusions that many other analysts have drawn have failed to look at the companies themselves and the systemic imperatives, the interests that they have when they're getting these contracts with governments in the first place.
Well, the interest that they have, I'd love if we could flesh that out for a sec, because every consulting company talks about efficiency. Like, that's their mm-hmm. buzzword, right? I mean, we saw this within the context of the train derailment in East Palestine as well, where these companies are contracting consulting corporations, and they're essentially saying, how can we make this corporation as lean as possible for shareholder value? That's a simplification, but I mean, I'm sure you can expand on that. But the fact that these governments have adopted this as well, it really speaks to the financialization of our politics over the past four or so decades, that this has become largely consensus, not just in the private sector, but in a lot of governments, including like the US and the UK.
Absolutely. I mean, it's no coincidence that the growth of this sector and the growth of governments outsourcing came at this time of kind of the rise of neoliberalism in countries like the UK and the US. You know, just to give you an example, at the beginning of Thatcher's tenure in 1979, the UK government was spending about £6 million a year on external contractors, on management consultants. By the end of her tenure, 11 years later, it was 246 million. So that was a huge increase in government. And a lot of the things that government was contracting these management consultants to do was things like advise on privatization advised on increasing efficiency in public sector services. Now, the problem with, you know, a kind of government by efficiency, right? So one thing is that we all agree that government should not waste public money. Governments should be efficient. They should be effective with public money. But the problem with having that dominate the way that we run government is it completely excludes other things that we should be taking into account when we're thinking about the capacity and the ability of governments to do things. So if we just focus on these efficiency measures, these short-term efficiency measures, so what can we do in the shortest, most effective way, in the cheapest way, if we just focus on that, then we lose, for example, an account of what implication does this have also for the knowledge, the training, the development of our employees, their livelihoods, the conditions of their job, ensuring that we're, you know, respecting labor agreements or collective agreements, and improving those conditions. You know, these kind of wider implications are completely ignored when we're only focusing on this, you know, short-term cost benefit, cost effectiveness.
I mean, it really is about defining what the goals are in this instance, right? I mean, because when an efficiency consultant comes in, the goal is efficiency as opposed to doing another job efficiently. Mm-hmm. If that primary job is to take care of your citizenry, let's say, broadly speaking, doing that should come first. I mean, this is the fundamental difference between business and government, it seems to me. And you're bringing people in with a business bottom line perspective, whereas that's not what government is supposed to do. It's supposed to help as many people as possible without, you know, and then maybe do it as efficiently as you can. But let's go to, I mean, I guess we can see this in the context of like McKinsey again in the opioid epidemic in this country. Their role both with Purdue and with the FDA. Will you walk us? This is an example of the conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we don't actually talk about this example in the book, not because it's not important. It's very important. I can talk a little bit about it, but it wasn't a focus of the book because it is quite a unique case. And we're really interested in the book in what cases tell us about these broader systemic issues. But certainly, you know, it's an example of a conflict of interest because McKinsey was simultaneously advising Purdue on how it was being paid. It was earning a lot of money from its contracts to advise Purdue on how to turbocharge sales of opioids, right? So if this company then has this incentive to, you know, I'm going to take this kind of one step kind of further back because I know we have to be careful when we talk about cases that we haven't talked about in the book, you know, legally and right. You know, this isn't something that we focused on. But let's take this one step further back. If a consulting company, in abstract terms, if a consulting company secures a lot of revenue from a client, then it has an interest in securing future revenue from that client. So it wants to give advice rather than giving advice that might be kind of in the long-term interest of that client or in the interest of society, in the interest of the healthcare of a population. The fact that it is seeking future lucrative contracts from that client invariably, and very often, of course, does shape the advice that it gives to that client. So it's more likely to provide advice that, you know, solely prioritizes the bottom line rather than any of these other considerations that we've been talking about. And I think, you know, it could be argued that that happened in, you know, McKinsey's involvement and McKinsey's advice that it was giving to Purdue Pharma.
What other examples would you give for that type of conflict of interest in how it hits, how it impacts? And again, this is a subset of the problems, but they all contribute to the sort of institutional weakness that government has in terms of being able to respond to anything.
Yeah, one area that we focus on in the book quite a lot, actually, is the growth of climate consulting. So this is a kind of nascent booming sector, or booming market for existing consulting companies. So all the big three and the big four, the names we mentioned earlier, all of these companies have invested heavily in their climate and sustainability consulting divisions over the past few years. And we see this, we see their growth also in the fact that, for example, BCG was the first ever consulting partner of the Conference of Parties in Glasgow, the UNFCCC Conference of Parties, the kind of big global meeting of environment ministers and other people who are important in environmental policy. They were the first consulting partner at this conference. This globally, this market is expected to be worth about $8 billion by 2028. That's probably a conservative estimate. I read another estimate the other day that suggested we're already there. This is also an area where the companies have a huge conflict of interest, insofar as their biggest clients are, or some of their biggest clients are in the fossil fuel industry. So to give you an example of kind of how other people, commentators have suggested that this is kind of manifested, the Australian government under the previous government paid McKinsey $6 million to do the analysis underpinning the government's net zero strategy. Now, subsequently, climate analysts found that this strategy was basically full of holes. It didn't actually get the government, it wouldn't get Australia to net zero by 2050. So it wasn't actually kind of setting up to do what it was saying that it was going to be able to do. And then other people started pointing out the fact that, hang on a second, McKinsey has advised 43 of the 100 biggest polluters. Could this be a reason why this climate strategy, you know, actually didn't make much sense? It wasn't actually very successful. Could this be a reason why the government contracted McKinsey to do this analysis rather than, for example, investing internally in their own or spending the money internally in their own kind of climate science division, which they do have in Australia? To do this, and in which case it might have actually been a better report.
Let's also talk about in the context of businesses. You talk about consultancy brought in as a sort of a shield in many respects. Talk about that dynamic.
Yeah, so this is very common in business in particular. It also happens in government, but let's focus on business. So just to kind of put, just to illustrate what we mean when we're talking about this in the book, we might find a situation where there are two executives of a company that have a competing vision or want to kind of implement a competing strategy and they disagree on something. So what they might do in that situation is contract one of the consultancies to do kind of analysis that supports their argument in this internal case. And this is something that came up a lot in interviews that we did with consultants who worked in businesses, who worked in the corporate sector. You know, they were saying this happens all the time. We're brought in to rubber stamp decisions that have already been made, and it's quite frustrating.
And what does it do, like broadly speaking, to warp economies? Is it simply that the warping happens in the context of efficiency becomes paramount, or is it also that there are irrational programs implemented that are irrational unless you look at it from the perspective of the consultant?
I mean, both of these, but also fundamentally, you know, if we live in democratic societies, these are supposed to be societies, these are supposed to be places where decisions that are taken in government and also in business are in some way accountable to citizens, or in business to workers often. In many places, we do have labor agreements in place. And what the introduction or the contracting at scale and scope of these companies can do is obfuscate decisions that are made in business and government. It can make it very difficult to challenge them, to question them, to even know what's going on, what the process was in the kind of decision-making process of a policy. So in various different ways, it warps the economy. Certainly one of them is that, you know, we end up with a very warped, skewed idea of what constitutes like kind of an effective use of public money, as we've already discussed in terms of efficiency, but also because it obfuscates accountability around decisions, which is an issue for democracy.
Let's talk a little bit about what you guys call consultology, because and some of it we've touched on as to why you might bring in consultants. But will you talk about what the consultants do, these companies do to, I guess, project an expertise that they don't really have. I'm fascinated by this part, because there is this presumption that these people do know exactly what they're talking about. But so many of the situations that they are in are unique enough that they, having never been part of this system, they couldn't possibly have genuine expertise at it.
Yeah, great point. Great. Yeah. So we talk about this a lot in the book right now. As I've already said, the growth of the consulting industry is not just a function of what these companies do, how they invest in creating this impression that they are able to create value for governments and clients and businesses, etc. But they do invest a lot of resources in creating the impression that they are the best people to do the job, if you like. They do this in a few different ways. So we know historically, you know, at least since the 1960s, the big companies have had a recruitment strategy where they recruit only from quote unquote elite schools, you know, elite graduates. And there's a historian called Christopher D. McKenna, who is a historian of management consultancies. And he's looked at how, for example, at Harvard Business School during the 1960s and 70s, it became McKinsey's strategy to just recruit from that cohort, from the top 5% of that cohort. And they did this because, unlike in like auditing or law or many other professions which require a formal qualification and which are regulated, unlike in all these areas, management consulting is not a protected profession. It's not regulated. Anyone can call themselves a management consultancy. So they have to find legitimacy in other ways, right? And one of those was, yeah, recruiting, or is still today, recruiting from these elite schools. Now, you know, other things that they do are to establish what we have described in the book, and which some other economists have described as quasi-academic institutions, right? So you might have heard of McKinsey Global Institute, which is probably the most famous one. Now, this is staffed with some kind of incredibly intelligent people with PhDs, again, from top universities, who certainly, you know, are often experts in the areas where they are doing research. But McKinsey Global Institute produces reports, and these reports can be full of really interesting knowledge. But a key function of these reports is not necessarily to distribute this knowledge. It's to market McKinsey as this kind of site of expertise and give the impression that the kinds of people who are going to be on the floor of your business or your government department are the ones who have this expertise, which is just rarely the case. The people who are working in McKinsey Global Institute are not the graduates who have, you know, 1 or 2 years of experience working in McKinsey, who tend to be the ones going into the shop floor. So, yeah, I mean, there are lots of different ways. Again, we talk about it in the book, the things that they do, the strategies that they employ to help create an impression that they are creating more value than they are. And, you know, we're very clear in the book to say it's not that they never create value, or that there isn't, you know, real intelligence and real expertise in these organizations, but it is certainly kind of not at the scale that is presented to us.
Right. I mean, it's a net value to society at the end of the day. Yeah. It's also, I found that fascinating, the imprimatur they get from sort of the top line academics at these, you know, institutes, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to, like, shower down, I guess. I mean, it's at least there's some consistency maybe in terms of like a trickle down economics. This is sort of like trickle down qualifications on some level that they're imposing. But what is problematic necessarily? Is there anything problematic from just getting everybody from Harvard? Like, I understand the dynamic there, that if you have a lawyer, they are accredited by the Bar Association. They've had to pass a bar. They've had to do certain things to create qualifications. If, you know, you're a therapist or something, you know, your qualifications indicate how much scrutiny you've had to achieve those qualifications. In management consultancy, you graduated. And if it's from Harvard, it sounds more prestigious. But is there a problem in and of itself with just getting all these consultants from a very small subset of people?
I mean, it depends, you know, what way you look at it and whether we think these consultancies kind of have any value as these generalists that can go in into different functions in the economy. You know, we don't focus in the end, actually, at the end of the book, you know, other people have argued that consultancy should be more regulated as a profession. And this is going to be the solution to the problems with consultancy that many people are identifying today, you know, both in response to the book, but also more broadly. You know, we think that the issue is more systemic than that. We think the solutions to the problem that we identify in the book are not going to come from kind of small tweaks to the way that consultants are recruited or the way that their profession is regulated. Actually, this is a systemic issue with how governments work, how we think about the role of the state and of government in our economies, and how we understand learning and, you know, all of these things that we've already talked about. This is not something that will just be fixed by, yeah, regulating the profession, unfortunately. But nonetheless, what I've described earlier is an important way that they help to kind of create this impression that they are legitimate, kind of neutral brokers of expertise in our society.
Let's talk about some of those solutions that you advocate. And I wonder, you know, I mean, I guess the book has been out for a couple of months. Do you have any sense of, like, the feedback? Has there been people in government who sort of look at this and go, like, oh, I see. Or, I mean, how, before we get to the solutions, I mean, I'm curious about that. Has there been, like, reactions to, like, this is a problem, or, like, yeah, no, we have a sense of this, but it really does insulate us from, you know, criticism, or it maintains my job. So thanks, but no thanks.
So, well, I mean, when we were writing the book, and we've been doing research in this area or adjacent to this area for a long time, we know that many people who work in government, and I'm not talking about necessarily politicians, though certainly many politicians also have, but many civil servants or people, just people who are working in the public sector, public employees, I guess, as you call them in the US, many of these people who have encountered or had to work with consultants in various guises, they identify a lot of these problems. They already know a lot of the stuff that we're writing about in the book is a problem. They don't necessarily, or before the book, you know, they didn't necessarily have a framework to kind of situate it within these broader problems and have something to point at. You know, if they are trying to challenge something by themselves, if they're trying to challenge a decision to contract out something to McKinsey that could be done in-house, they don't necessarily have the tools to do that themselves. So, you know, part of what we wanted to do with the book, we had realized through our research that this was an issue, was also, you know, not just kind of introduce some new terms to the political debate, but give people a tool within government to, you know, question the things that are happening in governments as well. And I mean, the response has been, I'm not just saying this to sound great, but the response from governments, from some governments, has been very, very good. Yeah. So we've had, for example, we were contacted a couple weeks ago by someone from the Senate who told us a Senate inquiry into the Australian government's use of management consultancies and issues with how they manage conflicts of interest in response to the book. So obviously that's a huge kind of great response. In terms of other conversations that we're having, you know, we've been invited to speak to policymakers about the issues in the book. Some governments we haven't heard much from, including the UK government, which might be for obvious reasons. They're busy with maybe, I don't know, saving, messing up the economy, whatever right. They do. But yeah, no, the response has been very good. And we're contacted on a daily basis by people who work in the public sector. Also many people who work or have worked as consultants, you know, just saying to us, this is exactly what it's like. This, I've been doing this for 20 years and this is exactly what it's like.
So where are the biggest sort of structural reforms? What are the most likely or, you know, I guess from lighter lift to heavier lift in terms of, like, the structural reforms?
So I don't necessarily, I don't like thinking in terms of likely and unlikely, right? Because actually the most likely ones are the small tweaks, which aren't going to change a lot. But the most necessary ones are the big systemic reforms about the remit of government, about how we think about government and its role in the economy. You know, we have that, we front load that in our kind of list of solutions, this more, yeah, systemic transformation that we see needs to happen with how we talk about government, how we think about government. So we're not just thinking about it in terms of this kind of cost-efficient actor that has to get out of the way as much as possible and let the market do as much as possible, but we recognize it as an economic actor in its own right that is there to deliver stuff and do things that citizens demand and want of it. You know, that's how we should see the government and as our kind of collective economic resource or as the thing that can bring economic resources to as many people as possible. Beyond that, though, we do also have reforms that can be implemented maybe on a more day-to-day level at the kind of level of government departments when they are thinking about contracting an external partner to really be thinking about, does this actor have the expertise or the kind of necessary experience that we need in-house? How are we going to learn from this? How are we going to get this knowledge, this learning back in-house? How are we going to absorb this when the contract is finished so we don't have to just keep going back to the contractor over and over again? We do provide some tools, some mechanisms that we think can be implemented. But fundamentally, you know, as with Mariana's wider work, we also think we need to rethink the role of government in our economies.
You know, one of the things that occurred to me as I was prepping for this, we recently under the Inflation Reduction Act, or I can't remember exactly which bill it was, that added about 80,000 new IRS agents. I mean, to be fair, it didn't necessarily add those as much as it authorized the refilling of those seats that have been, you know, those positions that have been lost because of prior budget cuts and anticipating attrition going forward. But we're already seeing sort of these reforms with the IRS in terms of like making it easier for you to file your taxes, getting your rebate quicker, just more efficiency and presumably more audits of wealthier people who have been evading taxes, essentially, so that it's going to generate more revenue. This feels like the type of thing that should be more celebrated as an example of government working efficiently. We have such a problem, particularly in this country, with demonizing government agency, even ones that do well, like the post office is amazing, as far as I'm concerned. Even our DMV is quite effective, in my opinion. And yet, that seems to me to be almost like a political project as much as anything else. And I guess it has to start with the politicians.
I think in part, but it's also, the US, I'm saying this as someone from the UK and I live in Denmark, right? UK and the US are quite similar in this respect. One of the responses that we have had to the kind of solutions, these systemic changes that we propose in the book is, oh, are you just calling for big government versus small government, blah, 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 blah. And that is totally the wrong framing. You know, we are right in the era of big government. Trump was big government. Reagan was big government in many respects. You know, spending on the military during Reagan increased something like 35% every year on average. These are big governments. So it's not a case of big government versus small government. It's what the government does and how it does it. That's what we're trying to address in the book with our proposals. I think we need to get away from this kind of framing of big government versus small government completely because it's a total falsehood.
Yeah, no, I agree with that as well. Rosie Collington, the book is The Big Con, How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Governments, and Warps Our Economies. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm and the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, I'm going to take a quick break, and we will head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free half, free of commercials, but you get the fun half as well. And you can IM the show via the free app. You can pick up the app at majorityapp.com. Don't forget, AM Quickie, amquickie.com. And you can become a member of the Discord at majoritydiscord.com. All sorts of things. And also shop.majorityreportradio.com. Pick up some merch. You'll enjoy that. Just Coffee.coop. Fair Trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Check that out. And somebody just said, every time Sam says the DMV instead of the RMV to appease the non-assholes, I cry on the inside. It's DMV. Is it not DMV?
Yeah, the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Is it something else in Massachusetts?
Maybe it's the RMV in Massachusetts, but I never knew that.
What would that mean?
Registration, Registry of Motor Vehicles?
Yeah, Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles.
Why they got to be different
it's just
here?
Just a registry, not a department?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know when that... that makes it better. That sounds like a Mitt Romney.
Yeah, honestly.
Reform. I don't go by that. I still call it the DMV. So.
Good for you.
Yep. Although, actually, now that I think about it, when I say it out loud, I say the Registry of Motor Vehicles.
Mm.
Sus.
Mm. Yeah. All right. Massachusetts. Go ahead, Emma.
ESPN. Yeah. Bye-bye, Celtics.
I mean, it's a little bit early.
It's not.
They get four games.
Oh, kind of yeah.
Right on time.
Four more.
They get, I mean, losing both.
Could be
a
turnaround. Could be a big turnaround.
Could be.
So, actually, the stat is 149-0 are teams in NBA playoff.
Went down 3-0.
When they're 3-0.
Well, how much more of a dramatic time would you want to do it than to be the 150th opportunity?
Well, either the Celtics or the Lakers have that opportunity, and I think both are going to fail.
Yeah. Well, and both will be doing kind of a discussion of those collapses and just, like, honestly, dominance by the Heat and by the Nuggets. We'll talk about Jimmy Butler and Jokic just being on another planet, and Matthew Tkachuk in the NHL on another planet as well. The Arizona Coyotes losing their referendum to stay in Arizona. No one wants them there, but the NHL is forcing them upon them to get a piece of the southwestern market. We'll be speaking about that and more. And also some anti-Palestinian discrimination in footy. We'll be touching on that as well. YouTube.com/ESPN show today at 4 p.m.
Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
This Sunday for Left Reckoning patrons, patreon.com/Left Reckoning. David and I talked a little bit about Elon Musk, several stories to do with Tesla, and also about RFK Jr.'s appearance with Crystal and Sagar. So patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get our takes on that.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. Head into the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh no! Are you ready?
Oh no!
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
and the alpha males are back, 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 and the Africans are black, 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 African, and the alpha males are black, 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 and the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total, 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 total